Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Today, we replay a broadcast from last June when host Jeff Humfeld spoke to Jackie Schroer about the life, hopes, and dreams of her daughter, Angie, whose death was ruled a suicide by the Independence, Missouri police. Then host Keith Brownell returned with Jackie to talk about the forensic evidence. Experts she contacted indicates that Angie was murdered. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn.
Jaws of Justice Radio has conducted interviews with surviving family and friends of murder victims for some time now. And it is our belief that it is more important to make those listening understand what they and their families and friends have in common. It is our hope that these commonalities will lead to more of us taking a role to prevent these murders. Today, we have a different situation than most. Angie Schroer's death was ruled a suicide by the detectives of the Independence Police Department. But independent investigators have looked at the evidence and do not agree. This is Jeff Humfeld, and I'm here with Jackie Schroer, Angie's mother, and Crystal, a family friend, to talk about Angie, who she was as a child, who she became as an adult. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio, Jackie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Crystal.
Thank you for having me.
I want to thank you both for coming in and for sharing her with the community and her friends and everybody else for the years that she was here. It's not easy at all to lose someone out of your life, and probably more so a child.
No, it's out of order. They're supposed to be there to take care of you when you get older, so it's out of pecking order, and it's the hardest thing I think anybody could ever go through. And I feel for, you know, you hear these stories over and over in the news, and you think, oh my gosh, but you never, it's, everybody says that you never think it's going to be your kid. And this club is not a good club to be in. It's one you don't want to be a member of.
Well, unfortunately, in the news, we focus more on the perpetrator, the person that commits the crime, than
right.
The person that has actually been the victim. And that's why we do these shows, is because we want people to understand who the victim is. And like I say, what the commonalities are here. This could be your family.
Right.
This could be your, you know, you.
I pray to God. I wish that nobody would ever have to go through this ever again. I've had a lot of help. I've got a strong family and strong faith, and they've been my rock through it all, along with my friend Crystal and other friends. But Angie, she was born screaming, and she was the tomboy. We have another daughter. I had one prior to marrying my husband. And so this is my husband's only child. My oldest is the girly girl, and Angie was the tomboy, like I said, who loves sports, eat, breathe sports. I mean, if she could call me 20 times a day and I couldn't get upset, but if I called her once, she goes, "Don't you know so-and-so's playing today?" "No, Angie, I don't," you know. I mean, she knew stats from before she was born, and I find it ironic that the two men that she did have a relationship with didn't care less about sports, you know, so they didn't understand all her Chiefs and, I don't want to get hit, but KU, love for KU.
Absolutely.
And she loved basketball. She was always a point guard starter. She did competition basketball, cross
very
country.
Very competitive.
And she had had a downfall at about the age of 20 on a Christmas Eve evening. And after that, she started into the drugs. But before that, she wanted to go to nursing school. And after she got herself clean, she started doing home health care. And she wanted to go ahead and go further with that.
Well, let's talk a little bit about her as a child. In other words, a little
as
kid.
A child.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was she kind of the rambunctious one, or you know, cutest kid on the block? Was she a force to be reckoned with?
No, she was really good, but it was my oldest daughter that was the ornery one, you know. But
we all have one of those in our family.
Right. she was one that, like, when she was like 6 or 7 years old, I'd wait for her at the bus stop, and the kids were in different schools because of the ages, and I saw the bus go right on by, and they didn't even stop, and I called the school frantic, "Where is Angie?" And they said, "Well, she's still on the bus." So the bus came finally back around. She had told the substitute bus driver, "Oh, we don't live there anymore. My family moved." You know, that was Angie. She was always the prankster.
Yeah.
She always, one time my daughter, I had both of them in cast at the same time, both of them. So if that wasn't horrible, taking them to the same doctor. Well, my youngest one, Angie, she had threw a skate out in front of my oldest one, and so both of them ended up in cast. And she denied and denied and denied that until just about a year before her death.
Oh, yeah, and but, she was just the sweetest looking little thing, wasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, but she was sweet. She had a heart
she
of
was.
Gold.
She genuinely was.
From the time she was born, she was really an old soul. She really truly was an old soul, and she could always see the good in everybody, even from she always took up for the underdog through school. I've heard from so many friends that said, you know, I was being bullied, this and that, and she took up for me. So that's good to hear. She just wanted to go fast in cars. My husband and her loved sports cars. She loved going fast. She loved music, anywhere from Bob Marley to Loretta Lynn to Pink Floyd. I mean, she had a open variety of music that she loved. And she was just a sweetheart. She never judged anybody, ever. She could always find the good in anybody.
Like you said, her aspiration was to become a nurse.
Right.
And all was she kind of the caregiver for the others around her?
Definitely.
When she was young?
Definitely. Oh, she would come in and she would rub my back if I wasn't feeling good. She would lay right there with me. "Mama, can I get you anything?" You know.
Very considerate and caring. That's the way she was.
Very much so. And later in life, when my oldest daughter had a baby, we were at wit's end. He was like this child that we didn't know where he came from. I mean, he would spill cereal just on purpose. I thought, oh my gosh, I got to get him in daycare. But anyway, he's changed since then. He's more like Angie now, but and he's 13, so I'm sure he wouldn't appreciate me telling this stuff. But nobody could get him potty trained for nothing. Angie had him for one day. He was potty trained. You know, and I'm like, it took Angie, who's never had a child, you know. She was very caring and just family-oriented, just like everybody, you know, a lot of other people in this neighborhood. You know, we all our family, thank God, live in the same area. We don't have family out of state or anything. So we're all right here and can lean on one another.
Well, that's a big help in a time like this, I'm
right.
sure. You know, You mentioned her older sister. What was their
Christy.
Relationship like? How were they at odds most of the time, or were they?
Yeah, it was like the show The Odd Couple. They had to share a bedroom.
Oh,
Angie was the neat freak, and yep. Christy, if you're listening, she was the clutter freak. You know, so it just would drive Angie crazy.
They were at odds over it.
So they were always getting on to each other here and there, but they were also good friends and rode their bikes together and would go up to ride up to grandma's and get in the pool or whatever. You know, they
typical
hung out
siblings.
Together.
Typical siblings.
Yes.
You know.
Well, what about how she related with her friends? Was she have a fairly good circle of friends when she was in school? Or
yes. She had really good friends. They all have, you know, they all went on to college and, you know, since then have you know, of course, graduated and married and had children. And she kind of felt like the lone duck in a way since she didn't go on to college. But she did have a hard time in school. She had to really fight to get good grades, where Christy, she could slack off and get good grades.
Still get good grades.
Yeah, so.
I know. That sounds like me and my brother.
Does it? Yeah.
She was a, you know, she did have a team, though, that she supported. And when it was basketball, you know, she knew how to be part of the team.
One time when she was playing basketball, you know, and they switched courts at halftime. Here's Angie, and I mean, we're winning, but not by much. And she goes to the opposite end of the court. She turns around. She goes, "Why is nobody clapping?" And we're all like, "Angie, you're at the wrong end of the court," you know? I mean, that was Angie. And those are the fun things I remember. And it's hard to remember some of that stuff at the beginning, because when this happens to you, it really does a lot to your head. And you can't think of the good times. And so I'm slowly getting some of that back. People tell me stories. I love, one of her friends sent me a card and said, "Each year I will tell you a new story," on her birthday. Oh, and wow. I thought that was so sweet. And I sent her and two other girls that had never been, I believe, on a plane or alone, let alone the ocean. And I sent them right after graduation to Fort Lauderdale for a week. And they stayed on the beach. Of course, they came back with some tattoos and piercings and met some guys that they still stayed in touch with along the way. But they had a good time. You know, she was a beach girl. That's who she really, truly was. You get her near an ocean, she was my fish, you know. She learned to surf. She lived in Hawaii for a year and learned, you know, she lived right on the ocean and just every day lived life to the fullest and always wanted to talk to anybody.
She lived down the street from me for a while, and she'd come walking her dog up the street, and she'd come over, and I lived in the corner house there, and she'd come over and we'd just talk underneath the shade tree, and then she came down to my movie room and we'd sit and just visit. Very relatable and just a sweetheart of gold. Just a very genuine person.
She didn't care what clothes you wore. No. You know, I was always, we handed them money left and right. And she did have to buy expensive jeans because she was so small, you know, she was so tiny. But other than that, she didn't want no name across her chest or anything. She just wore white tennis. A lot of times she wore white t-shirt, jeans, and white flip-flops from Old Navy. Cheap old white flip-flops. She had a
she liked
stack
Old Navy.
Of those things.
Mm-hmm.
High school's over. A lot of her friends went off. She did, you know, she didn't go to college. What did she do then?
Well, she worked at the stadium, and she loved that. Because when she got off, she could watch the rest of the games,
sports.
Where else better to work than the stadium?
Yep.
So she worked at the stadium, and then she worked at Cracker Barrel for a little while at the same time. She just couldn't find the right path. She didn't know which way to go. You know, she wasn't getting enough hours here or there. So she kind of felt bad about that. But she was starting to get around. She wanted to go to nursing school at that point, too. Her and my daughter moved out right after Angie graduated. They lived in our other house. So I didn't see her on a daily basis, you know, but she was working. And then at some point in her life, something horrific happened, and we kind of lost her at that point. That kind of killed her spirit.
It changed everything.
It changed a lot, and it changed who she was. I didn't know for quite some time what had actually happened, but that was kind of the downhill spiral.
You know, after that, she started to, like you said before, I think that she started to get her life back together, and she got into the home health field, which got her on the path to her goal, which was being a nurse. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That whole process with her and what got her into the home health care field?
Just for caring for people. I mean, she had done it before. She thought it would be a great part-time job. You know, she did it for a couple elderly men. And
There was something else too. She always loved kids. Kids could relate to her so easily.
She always wanted to coach basketball or football.
Yes.
She wanted to coach football really bad. And you talk about football games. Oh my gosh. You got all the guys at our house. Angie was the only girl player. They wanted Angie on our team. She could play some football. And these guys would come back and she could shoot pool and run the table.
Yeah. Yeah. She like did that nothing. A lot.
So,
you know, we do have a women's football team here in Kansas City. I don't know whether you know that or not, but I wish she was around now.
She would be right there in it.
She'd have an outlet actually play.
Yeah, because she wanted to play in school really bad. And I was like, you can't, you know. But anyway, she got into the home health care. And then that's when the stuff started spiraling down. And before we get into the rest of it, there was a couple years that she did not work because things got out of control and a drug addiction.
Yeah.
And I think what I would really like people to understand is if you haven't been affected by drugs in your family or know of somebody, then you're very, very lucky at this day and age. But when they want to get straight and sober, there's not a place for them to go. I don't care how much money you have. There is waiting list months long.
Very difficult to get help.
It is hard to get help for anybody. So she finally got clean on her own 6 months before her death. But watching a child go through that and the withdrawals, that's not what a parent wants to see.
No.
You know, and that wasn't our Angie. We wanted our Angie back.
You know, sometimes my mother lives down in Florida, and this is one of the things when I go visit and all, and I listen to the radio or some of these other things, and they talk about especially the area that she's in, the West Palm Beach and the Palm Beach area and stuff, and down to Lauderdale as well. They are like the center for these addiction recovery places and all, and so many of them are just shams.
Right.
In some ways, having the support of family and friends to help you through something like that is maybe more important than getting into a program. Of course, the family and friends got to learn, you know, what kind of support they need to give.
But. Right, and watching that, not knowing if your child's going to start seizing.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be careful with that, too, depending on what their drug of choice was. You've got to be careful. You know, they could die from that. I did have a friend that did pass away from getting off stuff, and he had a seizure and passed away.
You know, it's also going back to the root of the problem, what it was that created the pain that needed to be,
right,
you know.
And we got her counseling. We took her to several counselors for weeks and months, some of them. It's been very well documented. I know who the two guys were that did it. It was uncalled for. But I will say that her getting clean on her own, she always wanted me to be so proud of her, and I was very, very proud of her. I still practice the tough love instead of handing her everything like she was used to. So she was without a car or phone in her adulthood living with this guy. But in between the time, she did meet a guy that she knew from school, and his name was Nick. He's still here, so he's Nick. And he had a little boy that was born with some stomach issues and had to have several surgeries. And boy, that little boy called her mom.
She loved him.
She loved him with the mother instincts just kicked in. With I couldn't believe she couldn't tie her shoes right, but she could put a car seat in a car, you know. And he called her mommy, and she was the first person to get him to eat something, you know. And he treated her like gold, and they were truly in love with each other. The drugs came between them, so one had to go. I kicked her out of the house instead of him. The other house, they weren't living with us. At the end of her life, they were getting back together. So.
And she was she making plans to go to school?
Yes.
Then again, also.
Yes.
Well, I do appreciate your giving us a picture of Angie, because I think it's really important, once again, like I said, for us to understand that all of these problems that we have in our community are also in our families. They're also, you know, personal problems. They're also things that, you know, we all have a hand in and are affected by. And, you know, we have no idea what Angie might have been, you know, been capable of if she was around. And you know, from all indications, what you're saying, she had, you know, a heart of gold, so to say.
And she did.
She would have been somebody that our community still needs.
And she wanted that. That's why she was working so hard.
When we would drive down here, she would just stop at any stoplight we were at. She would stop and take pictures. She loved the architecture down here. It just amazed her. You know, I didn't care what, if it was a rundown building or a beautiful brand new building. She loved the architecture. She loved the people. Just an all around great person that my husband will never walk her down the aisle. We'll never have a grandchild by her. We're missing out on a lot, and it's all but killed my husband.
Well, we're sorry to hear that. That, you know, maybe somewhere down the line, a grandchild or you know, someone else's grandchild will touch his heart,
right?
And maybe help bring him back.
Yes.
Around, at least we hope so. This is a little bit different case in that the police claimed this was a suicide. In the second half of the show, Keith Brownell is going to come in and talk with you about the investigation. And this is one of the things, again, too, that I think that people need to understand, that there's problems with a lot of these investigations. You hired people to come and look at it, experts to look at the evidence, and they don't believe it was a suicide. So
right.
We're going to talk about that in the second half of the show, but now we're going to go to our calendar of events and some public service announcements.
Now the calendar for the week of November 18th. Moore Squared is having Kansas Issues to Action Night at First Baptist Church, 500 Nebraska Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas, Monday, November 18th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. Go to mooresquared.org. Also tonight, Monday, November 18th, the Kansas City chapter of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants will have their monthly meeting at the Chestnut Avenue Family Resource Center, 3811 Chestnut Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Missouri Cure advocates for the human rights of prisoners in Missouri prisons and jails, as well as those who have returned to society. Missouri Cure lobbies state and local governments, makes direct contact with corrections officials, and sends a quarterly newsletter to supporters and prisoners. The BITE and Kansas City, Missouri Dream Alliance ask us to join them to raise funds for deferred action recipients. There will be pozole and other dishes Thursday, November 21st, 5 p.m. at the BITE, 23 East 3rd Street, Kansas City, Missouri. Working together to improve access to justice for sexual assault survivors is a training event sponsored by the Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault, MOCSA, on Friday, November 22nd, 8:30 a.m. to noon at Regional Police Academy, 6885 Northeast Pleasant Valley Road, Kansas City, Missouri. This training is attended for sexual assault response team members and other individuals who interact with victims of sex assault throughout the Kansas City Metro. Registration is required. Email pickering@moxa.org with any questions. One Struggle KC Black Town Hall meeting hosted by One Struggle KC will be Saturday, November 23rd at 3:30 to 5 p.m. at the Kansas City Public Library, Lucille H. Bluford Branch, 3050 Prospect Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. See details on Facebook. My name is Teresa, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org.
And this is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brownhill, and I'm here in the studio this morning with Miss Jackie Shore and Crystal Turley. We're here to talk about the murder, unfortunately, of her daughter, Angela Shore, which occurred on June 21st, 2019. Jackie, the first thing I want to ask you is, how did your morning start off before you received the news about your daughter being in this unfortunate situation?
Okay, one correction I would like to make. It was 2017 that she passed away. She had called the night before saying that she was done. She was tired of living there. She couldn't put up with this guy any longer. She wanted me to come get her. But because I take a sleep aid, I said I couldn't drive. And I said, call me in the morning. I'll pick you up. And the next morning she called. I didn't have my phone, so I wasn't able to answer it. And I was outside with my dog, and she called her grandma, and her grandma called my husband and said, I think you need to call the police. She said, I love you. Take care of Snickers, which was her dog. She had done this a numerous amount of times, over a year. About a year and a half prior, she had overdosed a couple times on drugs. The first time she made this call like this, I sent the police. And I got a call back from Donald Greer, who she did home health care for and lived with as a drug dealer. There was a 40-year age difference. The first time I called the police, he told me never to do that again or he'd kill her and go suicide by cop. So on this, you know, we got used to these phone calls and nothing came of them.
Now, did he say he was going to kill her, or did he see he was going to kill her and everybody else in the family?
At one point, he told her he would kill all three of us when she was living with us, and she was scared to death of that. And I said, "We carry. He's not going to get in here, you know." And she was so petrified of him.
Were there any reports made to the police about his threats?
No, she was scared too. She said he was crazy, but I didn't know how crazy he truly was.
So virtually she was being held prisoner by fear.
Yeah.
Well, he was a felon. It still had guns in the house, did he not?
Yes, he was a felon, which we knew he was we knew he'd been in trouble for drugs, and that's what she knew. Mm-hmm. And whether you wanted to hear good or bad, she always told you the truth. And she never told me otherwise. We since found out he had murdered somebody. So had I known that prior, or had she known that, she probably wouldn't have been there. And I sure wouldn't have let her be there. And we're trying to get a law passed, actually, where they do a background check on every patient that receives home health care.
Well, I thought they already did that. I might be mistaken, but I would think that these home health care agencies want to know what type of people that they're putting in the homes of these folks that take care of them.
Right, because I know nurses that have their, you know, the firm LPN and everything, but they do it on the side, you know, for some money. And they don't know what they're getting into. And they're scared of some of the places they go to, too.
Now, how disabled was he? If he needed a home health care aid, he had to be qualified as disabled.
He was always... The medical records that I saw after the death was that he was anorexic and a drug addict.
Well, from your observations, were you able to observe that he was anorexic? Did he look like he was anorexic?
Yes, he did. He was 67. He led a hard life.
Yes, you could tell.
You could tell he led a hard life.
But physically.
But physically, he was okay to walk.
Yeah, he got around fine.
I mean, he's better off than I am.
Yeah.
You know? And a lot of other people younger than him.
And he picked up his wheelchair.
He picked up his wheelchair, put it through my car a couple days after Angie died.
The point I'm getting at is, like, did he look like somebody that might have been capable of inflicting the physical injuries on Angie that were found after she was deceased?
Very much so, because one time me and my husband's sister went and picked her up, and he had a gun on his front porch. We're like, oh my God, he's got a gun.
I know you don't really have to be top physical condition to have a gun.
Right. And he was, I think, adrenaline. He might have had some help after the fact. Whoever he had buy that gun, he supposedly had a friend buy that gun for him.
Well, for the record, let me run through the list of injuries and things that she had so we can give our audience a better picture of where we're trying to go.
Well, and Angie wasn't a big girl. She wasn't a big girl. She was always a tiny framed girl. And a 67-year-old man that can pick a wheelchair up and get around by himself, one punch can do a lot of damage to a young girl.
So now, she was found naked, right?
Found naked.
Okay, and they weren't in any kind of sexual relationship or anything like
that. Not
at
all.
But you had observed that he was obsessed with her as far as trying to be...
She was like his little trophy.
Yeah, on a more intimate level.
Yeah.
And she was shot in the head with a .22 caliber Ruger.
Right.
She had two black eyes.
Yes.
She had a broken nose.
Yes.
She had a split lip.
Yes.
She had teeth uprooted from the bottom line of her mouth.
Yes.
She had bruises on both forearms.
Correct.
One bruise on her thigh, and both ankles were broken or dislocated.
Right.
Now, these are, considerable injuries that you would think would come to anybody's attention if a situation like this occurred. And they're saying that in spite of all this, they still think that she committed suicide.
Right. The coroner's office released a statement a couple weeks ago on News Channel 9, I believe it was, that said there was no other indications to think otherwise than suicide. And none of these injuries are mentioned in the coroner's report, but yet they're in their coroner's pictures.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that very odd. I don't know why they're not mentioned.
Now, this occurred at 9:37 a.m., right?
Right.
When were you told about alleged suicide?
The Blue Springs police came to my house probably about 12:30 in the afternoon.
And you mentioned earlier that when you got over to the house, there was no yellow police tape.
No yellow tape, nothing. It looked like nothing had happened.
Mm-hmm. And you were able to go into the house.
We were able to go into the house.
You had a key?
Yes.
And what did you observe when you went in the house?
I saw a bunch of cell phones, and I was trying to figure out which one was Angie's. I grabbed two of them, and I found a gun, not the one that was used. But then I found the gun case for the one that was used.
So there was a gun still in the house?
There was still a gun in the house. This was a very small, maybe 450 square foot at best. We found those items, found some alcohol. He was telling me that she was so messed up on heroin. She was taking all kinds of pills the night before. And so I was thinking, for once, thank God, she didn't know maybe what happened to her. We got toxicology back. It came back clean.
Were there any witnesses to this incident, like neighbors or anything like that? Were they able to provide any information to the police, or did the police try to go to them and get any information like they routinely do?
One neighbor to the north of them did hear the gunshots. They both heard the gunshots, and nobody interviewed them. Police didn't interview them.
And the suspect, he told the police that he didn't hear any gunshots.
He didn't hear a gunshot.
Didn't hear a thing. Mm-hmm.
Well, he apparently must have been on drugs or something if he didn't hear all that. Now, was he just you said he was had been a drug dealer, right?
Right.
Was he just a drug dealer, or was he a drug addict himself?
Drug addict, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and he had served time in prison for killing one of his neighbors and was charged with manslaughter and criminal negligence. This was in New York.
Right, New York.
And then he had some other cases down in...
St. Lucie, Florida.
St. Lucie, Florida, just deal with drugs.
Maryland, he's had several.
Mm-hmm. Drug possession and firearm.
Yes, and all of them were discharged,
I think there was some information that came up that said that he had a wife that somehow she died in the same kind of almost identical way.
Right. Yes. That's what we were told by several people. Some of his friends, some of his neighbors told us that his wife died the same exact way, but same gunshot wound in the same area to the head, which is right in the forehead, center of the forehead.
And then there was this friend. He was supposed to be present with. They were walking on the railroad tracks, and they found him, his friend, laying on the railroad tracks dead after he had been ran over by a train or something like that. But he was present when this occurred.
He was present.
And none of these things seem to be a red flag to the police who are investigating
no,
this.
No, not at all. You know,
they still maintain that they thought that this was a suicide.
Right.
Okay, now after the homicide occurred, the house was set on fire 2 days later.
Yes.
Okay, and he admitted to one of his friends that he
set the house on fire. Neighbor that he needed to hide his car in their backyard. And she goes, why? And we were notified by another neighbor on Facebook. They were videoing and put it up on Facebook. It happened about 11 o'clock at night. And a few of the neighborhood kids had put a little shrine up for Angie with stuffed animals and a cross. He kicked all that down, tore those up, and then all of a sudden there was a fire. And it started in the basement with some propane tanks. But the police said that was neither here nor there. I do have the fire report.
This was a crime scene, but they didn't think it was important.
No, this had nothing to do with it.
And he was never taken into custody.
Never.
Never.
Rumor has it that he allegedly died in 2018, which was last year.
Right.
Have you been able to confirm that?
No, I haven't been told. My husband was told by the funeral home that, yeah, he supposedly died, but they didn't have enough information for a death certificate.
That sounds kind of strange.
Does that not sound funny? I mean, we're all on a paper trail and cameras daily, you know, so they've got to cut off Social Security and all that stuff and taxes too, you know. So everybody has to have a death certificate.
And that seems to suggest that he possibly had a bogus identity or something. He may have been in a witness protection program or something
where he was being hid out
by the police, and that may have been the reason why they were deterred from conducting a real investigation. I'm saying this is a murderous, serious stuff here.
Right.
And if they're trying to keep his identity a secret, is some information going to come out about him that they probably don't want out into the public?
Right. That's what we've been told. That's what we've thought all along. The detectives, I asked them I did talk to one time. He said that, I said, get him on gun charges. He's a felon with guns and a bunch of ammo. He goes, this is the meth capital of the world. And he goes, he looks like he's knocking on death's doorstep anyway.
So that justifies them not doing their job and leaving somebody out on the street that's capable of committing murder.
Right.
To continue to be out here where he can commit these type of crimes.
Right.
You know, and who was this detective that told you this?
This was Detective Cook. And after that, we had Detective Roach, who I have yet to speak with. I would love to speak with that man. He has not spoke with me or my husband, would not return our phone calls, won't return. I've started sending an email, but he won't return those either. I've not talked to anybody other than the sergeant that called a year after the death.
And this was Steve Cook and John Roach, right?
Right.
Now, talk to me a little bit about this, the gun that was allegedly used in the homicide. We're going to call it a homicide here. They saying the suicide, but it sounds like it's a homicide.
Right. I mean, and the pictures speak a thousand words.
I've seen those pictures, and they do strongly suggest that this wasn't a homicide.
Right. The gun we asked for, we hired a ballistics expert, John Caton, who was the head of criminology in Kansas City for over 30 years. We hired him and a retired private investigator that he knew. He asked for the gun, and I was told I had to go to gun court. We wrote a letter to the city asking for the gun. They said it would take over a year to get it back. They were going to do additional testing. This is after the case has been closed. Now they're going to do additional testing. And then I was in a meeting with Mike Hunt with a bunch of other people in a group setting. He was there, and I said, he goes, have John Caton call me. I'll get him the gun. We have still not got the gun, and I have learned that there's no such thing as gun court. Mm-hmm. And they said that I had to go in front of a judge, get the gun. And I said, who does the gun belong to? And he goes, oh, I thought it belonged to you. I said, did you not run it? And he goes, well, we ran it for stolen, and it didn't come back stolen. Well, they know who it belongs to.
Especially if it's not stolen.
Right. So they, you know, wanted me to come in and pick up a gun that don't belong to me.
Mm.
Is how I felt about that. Maybe that wasn't the case. But they called and said later and said that Angie's hands prints were the only ones on the gun. Even in the police report, Don admits to handling the gun And I said, where's his handprints? And they said they dissipate over time. But they're finding World War One victims by their guns to this day. You know,
and he told multiple stories.
Yes, he's told multiple stories. And Detective Roach calls him Donnie. Nobody called him Donnie except for one friend. Angie never called him Donnie. It was always Don.
What about the position of the body in the... I had some information that, indicated that the gun wasn't automatic, which means that it ejects a shell every time it's fired. And they were saying that the shell, from one of the reports I read, it was found under the couch or something like that.
The casing was found behind the couch.
Which was in the opposite direction.
Right, it should have came back in front of her. You know, when you shoot, they come back and hit you, you know, if you're a shooter, go target time or whatever.
Crystal, can you tell me a little bit about what you observed and how you came into the picture on the situation?
Well, Jackie called me and asked me to go over to the duplex with her so she didn't have to go by herself. She had told me a little bit about what they had seen the first time they had been there. And then when I went over, of course, I was just overwhelmed by the clutter and the mess. But what really initially surprised me was the fact is at the front door, looking straight to the east coming in that front door, the bedroom, the small distance between where Angie was on the love seat and where that bedroom was, the whole setup confused me because the police said they had to bang on the door and have him get up and answer the door. And the proximity of where she was and how she was on this love seat and how he had to get up and go to the door, I'm still confused on how he got to the door without falling over her or not seeing her. He goes to the door and they ask, where's Angie? Oh, she's right there. He had to have seen her. And yet, it's another thing, too. Like I said, I walked in the door and I said, Jackie, how did he not hear a gunshot? He's 10 feet from her. There's 10 feet between the love seat. And then the blood that had saturated the arm of the love seat, I'm saying she sat up here, and yet this arm of this love seat is saturated in blood. How she had to have been laying down when she got shot in order for that much blood to end up accumulating on that love seat. So to me, we saw when we started seeing pictures, initially the first thing we both said is it looks like she's been posed. She's been pulled up and sat there the way the blood flowed from her forehead, the blood on the love seat, just all these things, the alarm bells were going off.
Well, as soon as I was notified, I thought she was, police came to my house and said that my daughter had passed, and I said, where is she? Because I thought maybe she had relapsed on drugs and had an overdose, and I wanted to get to her immediately. And they said she shot, self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. I said, no, she did not shoot herself, because she knew Tim and I shot, me and her dad shot, and she was fine. You know, she went to the shooting range once with my husband and once with her boyfriend, but after the time she spent with Don, she somehow became afraid of guns.
Yeah.
To where when my husband was cleaning it, she literally freaked out. And I'm like, chill out. You know, I didn't know what was wrong with her. Now I know that he was probably had threatened her several times. And this time was the end of it because she did get her phone. She was getting back with Nick. And they would be married by now, you know.
I read in one of the reports that I think one of the investigators that you hired, he had determined that the gun was actually fired by somebody else because he said that it appeared that the gun had been pressed up against her head, and that the top part of the gun left an impression there.
Right, right.
And in the case that you hold it at an angle.
Yes,
exactly.
That she couldn't have held it from if she had fired it in the position that they are claiming that she used it to commit suicide with.
Right, the top of the barrel was closer to her head than the bottom.
And these two investigators, they worked for Jackson County for a number of years, and they thought that apparently they
worked for Independence Police Department. Independence Police Department. And I spoke with Mike Hunt about getting the gun. And because I even told him, Crystal was with me in the meeting. And I said, I'm supposed to go to gun court. He goes, what's gun court? But then he retracted and said, oh, I think I know what they're talking about.
Right.
And then that's when he said, have John Caton call me and we'll get them the gun. Mm-hmm. And that was 6-7 months ago.
Yes.
Have you tried since then to try to acquire it? Are you still making efforts to do this?
I'm still making efforts to do this. I'm not giving up, and I'm not going away.
Mm-hmm. And I certainly congratulate you for that, because this is more of what people need to do when these type of situations happen. Law enforcement is getting to the point where they're not trustworthy anymore.
No, I was brought up to trust and respect them. And I'm not saying that all of Independence is bad.
No.
You know, every place has their bad seeds, you know. But I've met with several other moms since then, have reached out to me since I've been on different news stations with similar stories. And that gets me, because it's different detectives, too. Mm-hmm. So it's the detectives all the way up to, I believe it was the captain or the chief, Brad Halsey, that got in trouble for sexual harassment about a year ago. And they ran my daughter's story a little bit with his that day that news broke. I think they need a clean house.
Did they perform any rape kit analysis on your daughter since she was found nude? This possibility that she could have been raped?
No. We asked for a rape kit.
Yes,
we asked for
there.
A thorough autopsy. Neither was performed, and we did not know until visitation, when people were starting to come in to see her. Mm-hmm. So now the chief medical examiner that was over Jackson County, now she's over actually Johnson County, Kansas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe a lot of people that think, my gosh, my Aunt Eileen or my Uncle Bill or, you know, Uncle Dan, I didn't know they were suicidal. You know, maybe it wasn't a suicide, but people have been brought up to believe what people said. And I just knew from start that it wasn't right, and I wasn't.
Well, I asked Mike Hunt that day in the meeting. I said, what criteria does a medical examiner go by to decide whether or not an autopsy is going to be taking place? Well, you get a 28-year-old somewhat healthy woman, young girl, and she's got injuries all over her body, and the alarm bell doesn't go off that we need to look this further, not just the gunshot. And they didn't. They overlooked all of it.
Right, and they put mitts on her hands. And Mike Hunt, who's a prosecutor of Jackson County or Independence, he said, I don't know why they bother. They don't test their hands. It costs too much money.
Mm-hmm.
I would advise people to go get to the medical examiner, get the reports, look at the pictures, even if it's a family friend.
Right.
Because
don't take it at face value.
Right.
So they didn't do any gun residue tests on the victim or the person that was in the house?
No, they did not test his hands. Supposedly, like I said, a year later, they sent the gun off, and it took a year for testing, which it only takes 2 weeks. And they said Angie's hands was the only ones on the gun.
Now, did she have any history of suicide attempts?
In the past, she had. I mean, this was like maybe a year and a half to 2 years prior.
How many times was this?
I'd say maybe once, and then one time that she overdosed, she swore that she hadn't taken nothing but hot chocolate that morning.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows what might have been put in her hot chocolate that day, because she told the truth, whether you wanted to hear it or not.
But this wasn't any serious suicide
attempts. No.
Okay.
No.
You know, we're almost out of time, and I want to express my condolences to you for your loss.
Well, thank you.
I admire you for your diligence in pursuing this matter. And I hope that when these things come up in the future, that other people will follow your example. You know, we really do appreciate you coming in, and we appreciate you coming in to be supportive of her, Crystal. Yeah. And good luck to you in your endeavors.
Thank you guys so much for having us. And let me get the word out there.
It's the 420 Drug War News. We're here at the Drug Policy Alliance gathering, St. Louis, speaking with Mr. Chad Sabora. He's with Mo Network. They're based here in St. Louis. Tell us about the work you do.
We run a hybrid harm reduction recovery community center. So we treat people and engage them at wherever they are at in their journey, whether it be still actively using with no intent on stopping, still using with intent on stopping, and early recovery and long-term recovery. It doesn't matter. We take a look at an individual where they're at and help them accordingly to reduce harm to themselves, harm to society, sustain their current recovery, or offer them alternative paths if that's what they're seeking. Well, we're one of the first hybrid recovery community center models in the country that encompassed the whole spectrum. We've been operating this recovery community center since 2015. We've been an organization since 2013. We're heavily involved in policy reform. We wrote all the naloxone laws in Missouri, 9/11 Good Samaritan laws, every drug policy law in Missouri I personally wrote. I was a heroin user up until 2011. I was also a former prosecuting attorney in Chicago as a drug user, so I had an interesting perspective on our drug laws and our war on drugs. So when I found recovery, I dedicated our work to more policy reform.
I hate to use the phrase hitting rock bottom, to find themselves again, to recreate themselves, does it not?
I hate to use the word rock bottom because
yeah,
that's,
I did too.
That's death, considering that fentanyl has poisoned our drug supply. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes what it takes for somebody to want recovery. And even if somebody doesn't and they just want to use, they're still human beings. They should be treated with dignity and offer compassion, health care, and other resources. So to people listening, your views on drug use, drug addiction are not your fault. We've had broken drug policy in this country since Chinese immigrants brought over opium in the 1840s. So your understanding of drug use, drug policy, criminalization was almost subconsciously implanted into you by your dad, your grandparents, your great-grandparents during the early 1900s when they passed the Harrison Narcotics Act. Make all drugs illegal, a couple Supreme Court cases that dictated what treatment was legal and what treatment wasn't legal. So everything we've done in this country so far has built a faulty foundation based on criminalization, prohibition, and arrest. We have to tear down this foundation and rebuild it in a public health setting.
And folks, if you want to learn more, I would urge you to go to Monetwork, that's MONETWORK.org. Once again, that was Chad Stabora of MoNetwork.org. I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow? Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.